On today's College Football Inquirer, $350,000 a year for low four-star recruits. Woo! It's getting expensive out there in these recruiting streets. Plus, is Miami holding the best roster-building formula in college football? We'll talk about it on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples. I was suspended for the Tuesday episode. It was a red card I received last Thursday. Yeah. VAR looked at it after the show came out. They said that I was not informative enough, and therefore I was out.
Please don't do that again.
And then Tuesday, I got hit up by a bunch of people saying that Tuesday's pod was extra informative and good, and we should continue like that.
Let me tell you what that's proof of.
I'm fired.
That I am an excellent hustler. Okay.
There you go.
Missed my calling as just a straight up con man.
Well, this is going to be a fun one, guys, because we've got a story that my colleague Pete Nakos put out at On3 about the market for recruits right now, because this is the time when you're seeing most of the movement for the recruiting cycle that is to come, or the recruiting cycle that is going on now. So you're seeing a lot of the best players in the class of 2027 commit now. And in a lot of cases, the deals have been made, or the money promises have been made. And according to Pete, and he's talked to a bunch of different personnel people all through college football, that the starting price for a low four-star, so low four-star would be, we could be talking about the 350th best player in the country, $350,000 a year, which is a lot of money, especially if you go back a few years. $350K, the first year of NIL probably was getting you a starting quarterback,
right?
Who was a veteran. Mm. Like, this is very, very different. And the different personnel folks are talking about how everybody's got agents, everybody is manipulating the market. This is very interesting for a lot of reasons. And Godfrey, I know you have a lot of questions.
I do. So I want to ask a question you may not know the answer to right off the bat, but you do work at On3, so I bet you know somebody who knows the answer. Five stars in the history of like recruiting analysis are usually pretty sparse, right? They kind of like meter those out when they were awarded in the old days, right?
It's like 50,
well,
right?
Well, or something. I can tell you 40? Exactly how it's awarded.
Yeah. Okay.
Right now.
Go for it.
At least by Rivals and On3, they're 32 five stars.
32. Okay.
That corresponds to 32 spots in the first round of the NFL draft.
Ah. Mm. Makes sense.
And basically, a five star rating is awarded to someone who projects as a first round NFL draft.
Great. Okay. My next question is there a governor on the number of four stars?
Not necessarily, but it typically is in the high 300s, low 400s.
Okay.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because three stars, because we view three stars and four stars the way we view them, but three stars can go down into the 2200s.
Sure.
So
but we're talking,
there's a lot of three stars.
Okay.
You know,
so 300 to 400 individuals a year, let's say roughly, are getting a four-star ranking. And then Pete's reporting is 350K on average. That feels correct. Doesn't this feel like the market actually bearing itself out? And stay with me here. If you look at any industry, so you have the exceptional individuals, the 32 that are above consideration. And then you have the sort of like, hey, 300 to 400 individuals every year are going to be arguably the very best underneath the exceptional ones. And they're going to make about $350,000 a year. That kind of feels correct. That feels like a white collar American economy type job.
But, people don't expect that.
Well, people don't. Tough. They should start to expect it. Yeah. I thought by now that they would have expected it. I mean, because I saw that number and I thought it seems low.
My like, that was my reaction. Ross.
My reaction.
Ross has got a little agent blood in you.
Signing classes are going in between 5 to 8 to upwards of $10 million. Signing classes. So if you do the math, 20 players at $350,000 is $7 million. Like, yep. That wasn't a surprise to me. That's about right. Right. That's
where we. That's sort of where we are. Robert Barons, who covers Texas A&M, joked on Twitter that, you know, since that 2022 Texas A&M class definitely cost $30 million, like everybody said.
Yeah.
The $10 million that Texas A&M is spending, which is allegedly the highest in the class of 27, Moneyball. Clear Moneyball.
Well, that's where I want to go with this, Andy. And I know that,
which, by the way, should reinforce that the $30 million figure was BS.
How sure are we that Texas A&M is spending the most? Like, you know, maybe there's a team in South Bend that's spending
a
lot.
We're not entirely sure. And Texas A&M and Notre Dame in Pete's reporting are the ones that came up.
Okay. Yeah, I think the Notre Dame is the one that people have told me more about over the last few months. But either way, that's the high end, right? And that makes sense. $350,000 figure is put you at about 7-8 million.
Okay.
You know, now, if you have a bunch of them.
Here's the issue. The issue with all of this is, you know, and if you ask a GM or if you ask an athletic director or a coach, where they get frustrated is a lot of that is sunk cost. If you're doing that for linemen, they might not be ready to see the field for at least a year, and maybe not 2 years. And so you're promising, and look, most of these deals have escalators. Most of these deals that like, $350 your first year, $500 your second year, $750 your third, like that's how that roll. But a lot of that is sunk cost. The NFL, by the way, had this issue for a long, long time.
Yeah, they did.
And then the Sam Bradford contract happened, and the NFL owners and the NFLPA got together and said, hey, why are we doing this to ourselves?
Sam Bradford went to the Rams when they were in St. Louis following the Oklahoma career and was grossly overvalued, overpaid, honestly, for what he actually created in the NFL in terms of worth.
Yeah, veterans in the NFL got together and said, wait a second.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be giving this money to rookies. We can control this.
Yeah.
And they changed the CBA. Obviously, there's no CBA in college football, so they can't do that. So you've got to figure out what to do, and it opens up a lot of possibilities.
So this these are the questions I have now. For the last 4 or 5 years, I know each of us, when you're in your daily life, you get questions about, hey, is this a lot? Is this too much? Or how's my team doing? And I think honestly, the only the real answer we should all be giving, because I think sports writers often, way too often, try and pass themselves off as experts and say, hey, this is an emerging market. We don't know. Ross and I talked on Tuesday, Andy, about kind of the rough estimation of what Ross Bjork said the national championship Ohio State team of 2 years ago spent, which was a $20 million price tag. So we know that this is beating inflation by a considerable margin. This is a steeper roller coaster.
It's almost as if the market was suppressed by a group of competitors colluding in violation of a federal law.
Well,
and now it's not.
Rather than me get on the old soapbox.
And then they all front loaded.
Yes.
Right.
Well, but again, that actually makes pretty good business sense, because if you're Ohio State, you still underpaid relative to the next 10 years value of players. You got a national championship out of it. You cooled the seat for your head coach. You don't have to go through a buyout process for at least a couple more. It makes sense to front load, I think. But here's the question I'm trying to get at. Are we arriving, Andy, at enough data publicly for teams to, we use Moneyball, we overuse the concept of Moneyball, all right? However, several someones are trying to do exactly that in the market, where they're looking at A&M, they're looking at Notre Dame, they're looking at Miami, who we're going to talk about in a little bit, and they're saying, we can't live in that space in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Now, we might pull a 1997 Florida Marlins occasionally, and we're going to jack our payroll up, go title or bust, and then take the thing apart the following year. We haven't really seen a team do that in college, but I don't think that it's out of the realm of possibility. But the smarter thing here is what people are trying to do, which is people are trying to say, all right, how can we better manage a consistent, let's say, $30 million? And if we know now that we're paying about $350,000 for a 4-star, is this the piece of data we need to solve for X?
This brings us to something Ross mentioned before we got on the air.
Okay.
Ross, you have a story coming out at Yahoo about what the Big Ten and SEC want to see out of the Protect College Sports Act. There is one particular little bit of that I found very, very interesting. Could you tell us what that little piece is?
Yeah, it's sort of the latest recommendations that the Big Ten and SEC have sent the lawmakers in their membership, their schools, kind of like a 4 or 5 page memo. And one of the 10 recommendations of changes to the bill, one of them is titled Make NIL Transparent. And then it goes into detail about basically, figures should be reported for each school. And perhaps it kind of suggests that there should be a database of some sort where schools can look at what each other is spending on their rosters, basically. And one of the lines in here, each of the 10 sort of recommendations has three different questions, and then there's an answer, right? So it's like, what is the issue? What needs to change and why it matters? Well, under this one, under Make NIL Transparent, what is the issue? The answer is, and I'm reading it line for line, you cannot enforce rules if nobody knows what is happening. That's it.
Okay.
That's a lie.
Interesting that they do it like that. They say it like that. Because it has nothing to do with rule enforcement. It has to do with cost control. Mm. And this is a perfectly legal method of cost control called letting information get out. And so these guys and the smart ADs have already been talking about this. The dumber ADs are the ones that are trying to keep this a secret.
Yeah.
But the smart ADs are like, we got to figure out how to make this a transparent system.
Right.
We got to figure out how to make it where everybody knows what everybody else is spending, just like the NFL has.
Yeah.
Andy, I think too, like most of the ADs, I think, would be okay with this, but they're so scared that the other AD won't agree to it or won't do it, or the other school won't follow the rules and reveal their numbers.
You all want it, and you don't need you actually don't need congressional action. You could go back to your state. So some of them have gone to their state legislatures to get them to create laws that mask these things.
Yeah.
Go to your state legislatures and make them make laws that unmask them.
This is we think this is a good thing, right? I think we the journalism hat on.
If you're a player agent or a 4-star recruit, because the more they're in the dark about what everybody else makes, the more you're going to make.
But hang on. Mm. Advocating as we have thus far in this segment for the idea that, hey, these guys are finally getting paid their market value, and bully for that, we're all happy about that. We are. I'm not trying to be facetious. If you look at the NFL as your example, Andy, I'll pull up a random position just recently because of my own fandom with Kyle Pitts. There's a market for tight ends. There's guaranteed money. There's contracts. So George Kittle, the 49ers, has set the market. It's his total contract value. We know what it is. It's $76 million. Mm-hmm. It's arbitrary for this discussion. Then you know who has the most guaranteed money, and that's Trey McBride of the Cardinals. Any other tight end that's signed in this last cycle or the next cycle or someone who's going to get franchise tagged.
Do you know why we know that, Godfrey?
This is where I'm going. Tell him.
Yeah. Because NFL teams, first agents leaked the salary numbers to the reporter.
Yes.
That would be the full amount of the contract.
Yeah.
If you went all the years, which half, the two on the back end don't even exist in real life.
Right.
But if you went all of the years and then you hit all of the bonuses, that's the number that the agent gives you. Then the teams come in on the backside and leak the guarantee and the actual contract terms. And through this, databases are built showing exactly what everybody's going to make.
Yes.
And there's a reason for that.
Yes.
It helps the NFL teams decide how much to pay people.
Right. So I want to, let's stay here before we jump off in several other directions. We have said before, hey, it's consensus now. It's assumed public knowledge. It's the public sentiment, Andy. Like we talked about with Bediako, the public sentiment was we don't want this. The public sentiment is, all right, pay these guys, pay the 4 stars, pay the 5 stars, especially market value, right? We need to also hold two competing thoughts, which is if we want college sports to survive and we believe even 1% of the claims that this is going to bankrupt teams or this is going to be too excessive, et cetera, it stands to reason we should then advocate a little bit. Man, I'm going to be really careful about this. A little bit on the behalf of schools and athletic departments saying, hey, we need to understand the market so we are not consistently overpaying and kneecapping our own finances. I think that's that would be a fair transaction for both parties. Are we okay with this? I'm scared. Absolutely. I'm scared because I'm leaning in on the other side, which usually bites me in the ass in a philosophical way.
I mean, look, this is it's not a matter of rooting for one side or the other.
It feels like common business practice.
Yes.
And I think
the most efficient system possible.
And I think there's a desire by the stat, like lawmakers that authored the bill, to maybe do this or to certainly give serious thought to it. But you'd obviously have to put around it some parameters to protect certain privacy things, maybe. That's also in the recommendation.
What you need to do is stop pretending you're not paying them to be good at sports.
Yeah.
Just pay them directly through the schools. Like
yeah.
the NIL stuff, it's them creating this weird semantic wall
about why
they're paying them.
Right.
Just stop doing that.
You took my word.
That would be the easiest solution.
You took my word was that every time we can see the horizon of sensibility when it comes to the finances of this sport. And then what always gums up, spanner in the works, as the Brits say, at the end is this semantic need to act like we're not doing what we're doing, which is that we are paying athletes to play sports so that we can generate revenue from their athleticism. And that there's nothing to do with being an English major.
Because of one word, right? Employment. Mm-hmm. Everybody's scared, right?
Guess what? You're paying them to do a job and you're holding them to the requirements of a job.
Sounds like employees to me.
Everybody thinks they are.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like employees to me. I was on a separate pod yesterday and they asked about the employment debate and we walked through how there's nine questions that determine whether a person is an employee of an entity. And it's all about control and, you know, seven or eight of the nine requirements college athletes meet, maybe all nine.
Yeah. But all right, let's talk about this because that is another conversation for another day. That is a long conversation for another day.
Yes.
Let's talk about the money itself because there's one type of school that absolutely hates what's going on right now. There's two types of schools. Well, one doesn't care and one is thrilled about this. And so let's go through the three types of schools here. Mm. The type of school that doesn't care about this is the type of school that was never going to get four and five star recruits anyway and can't afford to buy them now. They're just where they always were. Nothing has changed for them. The school that is thrilled about this is the one that couldn't get the best four and five star recruits, but has some money and now can. Cough, cough, Texas Tech. Cough, cough, Miami. The school that hates this is the one that always got those players.
Mm.
And now maybe doesn't have the money to get those
cough,
players.
Cough, Alabama. Cough, cough, Georgia.
Yeah. Sorry.
I think Georgia has the money.
Yeah.
But I think they're trying to be fairly judicious with how they spend.
They are. So,
this is
not
where
spending like others.
This is where we get into kind of my neck of the woods, which is talking to the old school people who used to do these things, and there's an ideological crisis right now. The only thing I can tell you, this is not a warning. This is not a reprimand. This is not anything else. If you are a check writer at one of these places that has achieved success historically in college football, and you are ideologically opposed to your check going directly to Rev, to paying the players, you are going to, in the immediate, near, and then long-term future, cost your team wins. I'm thinking of one particular program right now that has been very successful, extremely successful, has a lot of statues of coaches in front of the stadium. Popular college town, although I don't think it's as good as Athens or Oxford personally. located off I-20. Always traffic on McFarland. I don't know why. Sometimes I stop there to go to the Chipotle. Maybe, hypothetically, there's a problem there right now with the ideology of, well, we didn't have to do this back when. We didn't have to do this. When you hear we didn't used to have to do this amongst boosters, you might as well go ahead and order the gravestone for your football program. Okay. Because this happens at every level, guys. Complacency sets in. It's a big group of five FCS problem I've talked about for years on my other shows. But if one happens to be a national title winning program and has expectations that they can achieve said results without acclimating to the current market, one is in for a shocking, potentially seven or eight win season, hypothetically, maybe this fall.
But I will push back on that a little, Godfrey, with the Alabama example specifically.
I didn't say Alabama.
I have sat in that traffic on McFarland, so
that could be any town.
Try to get out of that Panera Bread.
Oh my area. God, what's up with that left turn? Oh my God, that intersection.
All right, we'll get into that.
Jim and Nick's,
but that's true. Okay, so
hard pass. Well,
here's the thing.
Gasp.
Alabama has dealt with Texas this before. Forever. They have been in the we've always done this way. This has always worked for us.
Yeah.
And we've hired, and it before it was we have to hire someone who had a connection to Bear Bryant.
Yeah.
And then that stopped.
Yeah.
And they hired Nick Saban.
Mm.
And that didn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
It wasn't an issue anymore.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. They have adjusted before.
They have.
I believe in their willingness to win
Andy.
Enough
Andy.
That they'll adjust.
Andy.
Yes.
I thought they've adjusted already.
Andy.
I think they got started slow, but it feels like they've adjusted.
Yes, Ross, I think the people in charge, to Andy's point, in the post-Saban era are the best professional for the best position possible and not this golf club fraternity cronyism that used to just plague the Southeastern Conference. He's right. Andy, you're right about that. It's the check writers. It's the people who you ask the money who may be still kind of stuck in the past. This is a real problem. If I'm hypothetically the athletic director at Alabama, I didn't say Alabama, a school on I-20 with national title standards in perpetuity, this is a real problem ideologically. Curious, Andy, though, Georgia is sort of the post NIL era Alabama. Mm-hmm. And you said earlier, I think they've got the money. I agree with you. I think they've done more in the really boring parts of running an athletic program, corporate sponsorship and that kind of stuff. They really kind of professionalized. I talked about the glow up of their stadium experience, but that's a trickle down effect from working with corporate sponsors. Are we more confident that they could acclimate of the teams that were good before? It feels like that's the one that feels like it could professionalize.
I'll go with something my other On Three colleague, Steve Wiltfong, told me last year.
The genius.
Kirby Smart thought the numbers were BS for the first few years of the NIL area, and last year realized they weren't.
Yeah,
I think it's gonna be like, for example, Georgia has an offensive lineman coming in, a freshman this year, class of 26, who's probably gonna start as a true freshman. Like, you got to pay for those.
Yeah,
those are expensive.
There's corporate sponsorship all over Atlanta and Athens. Like, you should be able to make that happen in short order. Because there's another team we're going to talk about in a second that's also in a major metro area. By the way, you talk about drives, Andy. You drive from that 285 corridor to Athens. You never really leave Atlanta anymore. I'm sorry. Okay?
No.
I say this as a Georgian. It's all sort of one thing. But they need to tap in, all joking aside, to that corporate sponsorship. I feel like they would be better positioned than hypothetically another team that won a lot of national championships in the last decade that might be on I-20.
I think they might be, but there is another school. I thought we're going to a different direction. Mm. Another school I want to talk about that is one of those that has the money to do this, was not doing it in the previous era, and is spending this money, but is spending it, I would say, not willy-nilly. So let's talk about the U when we return. We are back at the College Football Inquirer. We talked about three types of schools in this new era, where there's the group that couldn't afford the big time recruits and still can't afford them now, and they're like, whatever, nothing's changed.
Yeah.
There's the group that used to get them all, doesn't like that they got to pay more for them now. They're in trouble. Then there's the group that wanted them, couldn't get them because they were all going to Georgia, Ohio State, and Alabama. And now they can get them. Miami Hurricanes, definitely a member of that group. We were talking about offensive linemen and freshman offensive linemen. In the class of 26, they have the number one offensive line recruit, Jackson Cantwell. He's probably going to start for them this year. They're paying him a lot of money.
I'm kind of like, before we get into this in all seriousness, is anyone else terrified that the amount of like you know, we go through these periods of American history where the city of Miami or the culture of Miami suddenly becomes prominent again. And then maybe once the history passes, we're like, well, that was a rough time for America. I mean, between you got Miami football prominent again. You got all of American soccer going through Miami with Messi. You know, GTA 6 is coming out this fall. Shout out. I mean, there's a lot of Miami culture. I'm a little terrified, to be honest with you, Andy. If Miami football, and I say this with a little bit of reverence and a little bit of fear, but those of us who are old enough to remember the old Miami dynasties, how they were built, how they fell, that ideology is still, I think, in the bones. Maybe not the individuals. We don't have the same people doing the same things, Andy, but this kind of wanton aggression, you know, capitalist initiative that fueled Miami boosters for years in a negative way. This is where I have more questions. Is that paying out so far? And they're not just, Andy, mm-hmm. they're not just overpaying. I think a lot of people... Let's go back to Georgia for a second. Narrative construction in last offseason, Ross, I'm sure you heard this on campus visits, was, hey, we're not necessarily torn up to see Carson Beck walk out the door, right? We feel good about Gunnar Stockton. And then the whispers in the coach gossip sort of world was always like, ah, you know, they overpaid for Beck. Typical Miami. He's not that good. Yeah. Have you seen him throw arm strength? Da, 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 da. Guys, they were a drive away from winning the national championship, okay? So whatever mm-hmm. you spent on Carson Beck, how many programs right now would say I'll overspend on a mid quarterback if it gives me a chance mm-hmm. to have first and 10?
But did you have the rest of the roster? Did you have two first round D linemen and a first round offensive tackle?
This is where I'm going. Yeah. It seems like they're spending a lot. That's a fact. But we established in the first segment, guys, you got to spend now. But Andy, are they spending well? And if so, is there a discernible methodology?
I think they've got the right roster building formula, and that's really what this is.
Okay.
Like we talked about Georgia having the money, wanting to spend it judiciously and not waste it.
Right.
Well, Kirby Smart philosophically still believes that the best way to create a great team is build it up through high school recruiting.
Yeah.
Particularly on the lines of scrimmage, but really throughout the entire organization. Mario Cristobal, I think, has a little bit different philosophy. So he came on our show at On3 last year and really broke down the whole philosophy and the whole strategy of it, which it was the first time I'd ever heard a coach explain the different buckets that they're looking at and why they care and why it matters to them. So Mario Cristobal's thing is spend at a high school on the guys that are super high ceiling that you would never, ever be able to get in the transfer portal. Because when they get where they're going, they're so good that they are the ultimate retention target. So this is the we regret not getting Jeremiah Smith. We tried. We came in second.
All right.
So the next time a Jeremiah Smith comes out of South Florida,
yeah,
we can't miss.
So
him.
Hang on, real fast. So we're Malachi Tony. So hang on. We're talking about 32 5-stars. So we're talking about ostensibly mm-hmm. 4 to 5. We're going to target financially 4 to 5 5-stars per class. Hit on mm-hmm. 3. And yep. make a significant upfront investment in them for the duration of their employment with us, for the 3 or 4 seasons before they go to the league. Good.
And this would be Jackson Cantwell, who will probably start at offensive tackle for them as a freshman this year, who is the 2026 version of CeCe Mauinoa.
Okay, hang on. But if I've got three, can I say this? It doesn't regard position. So let's say I land 3 to 4 5-stars in a class. How much money did I just spend, or do you need to know the positions? This is what people are asking.
I would need to know
probably the positions, because if one's a quarterback, right?
One's a quarterback. Well, one's
but,
a.
But in Miami, it's not.
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in Miami, it's not. Well, they're shifting maybe, now to yeah. that. Right. Yeah. This is the other problem: is that the blueprint that they established by bringing Beck in is different than what they're doing now in recruiting. If I understand.
Mm. Well,
it's probably $2 million.
The quarterback.
$2 million.
Spending on a quarterback thing is the one question I have, because it feels like the one difference in the formula, because their formula has been we can rent the quarterback.
That's what I was getting at. Yeah. Okay, let's say it's a quarterback now, because I know that they have shifted their focus to establishing a blue chip quarterback prospect at the high school level. How much am I paying for that this year?
Well, then it's like $4 million.
Is it $4 million? Okay.
Right.
All right. And then
Israel Abrams is not the number one quarterback, but he's a top 40 player in the country.
Okay. So I spent $4 million on the quarterback. I still have 2 or 3 more 5-stars to go. Andy, what positions and then how much am I spending real fast?
Well, let me give you the positions on the 5-stars that they have in the 27 class.
All right, let's do that.
And then we'll go. So Dante Wright is a corner from Long Beach Poly. Go Jackrabbits.
Nice.
Remember when Snoop Dogg and Cameron Diaz went to school there together?
Yeah. He wore that sweatshirt in one of the, I think, Gin and Juice video.
Yeah, he's a 6'1 corner.
Okay.
They don't grow on trees.
No.
That's a tall ass corner.
Expensive.
Nick Lanier is a 5-star receiver from Miami Carroll City High School.
Love it.
5-star receiver out of South Florida. There's your Jeremiah Smith comp. Mm-hmm. Like, can't miss him. Can't lose him.
Okay.
Cannot lose him. All right.
Corner, wide receiver. And then one more.
Jaden Bryant, Irmo, South Carolina, suburban Columbia, plucked right from under the Gamecocks' noses.
As usual.
Edge rusher, 5-star.
DE, 5-star. Okay. So how much? So $4 million, Ross said, for the quarterback. So I've got a corner that feels exceptional and generational, standard 5-star wide receiver from South Florida, and a defensive end from the heart of SEC country. Boys, what am I spending right there? So $4 million plus, I need 3 more price tags.
Are these one-year deals?
Well, no, these are probably multi-year deals, so we don't know exactly. They would escalate.
All right, I'm going to throw a little hockey in here and scare everybody. Can I get an AAV, average annual value?
I would say average annual value. So you said $4 million for the quarterback. That sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, $8 to $10 million?
For the three of them?
For all probably. Those players?
Or for all of them?
For all of them.
All right, eight to 10.
For all of them, including the quarterback.
Okay, so 8 to 10, let's say $8 to $10 million right now. And we're going to be position agnostic after quarterback, just because I'm trying to speed this along.
Well, especially as you go down, because this is the other thing about these types of schools.
Yes.
Is it's not like a Nick Saban Alabama recruiting class where the 23rd player is better than the number one player in Wisconsin's class. It doesn't work that way anymore.
Okay. So I have $8 to $10 million on my crown jewels. And then I've got... let's go into this 4-star thing now and explain to me, because anybody can spend that on a handful of players. I can probably name other schools that are doing that. It doesn't feel like that's the part of the Miami methodology that's so exceptional, Andy. Is it the thing? Yeah, next?
You have to remember the other parts of it. So we talked about the freshman or the high school recruiting piece of it.
Yeah, that was high school kids.
There's two other pieces.
We just signed high school kids for $8 to $10 million. Dollars. Now, how much am I playing with?
Yeah, there's two other pieces of it. There's the 1-year rentals,
right?
Yeah.
So right now your 1-year rentals that you're really spending on are Darian Mensah, your quarterback, who we believe they spent about $6 million on. If you go by what he was supposed to get at Duke, you obviously had to spend more to get him.
Yeah. Well, look, I
probably had to pay a buyout.
I failed every math class in college, but I think that means $10 million are at the quarterback position, and maybe about 60% of that is actually seeing the field this year. So there's your sunk cost, okay?
Right.
So $10 million there.
You got that.
All right.
Cooper Barkate. The receiver from Duke, who was Duke's leading receiver, who came with Mensah.
As you do.
Damon Wilson, who was the best edge rusher at Missouri last year. Remember, Georgia's suing him. He's suing Georgia because he left Georgia for Missouri.
Okay.
But he went to Missouri last year. Now he's at Miami. That would be your biggest spend there. So those are your 1-year rentals.
All right. And so price tag on a 1-year rental. Let's do an estimate real fast. Boy, journalists don't like being specific when they're asked questions. That's what I noticed about you too. All right. Do you want to say another 8 to 10 or a little bit lower?
On how many?
No, that
on your 1-year rental, maybe
what you're spending on Mensah, that's probably right.
Yeah, another 8 to 10 on the rentals. Yeah, it would have to be with the edge rusher and the receiver. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so we are now in the neighborhood of $16 to $20 million for a handful of players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How much money do I have left if I'm Miami to actually build the roster? Rotation tackles.
$20 to $25 million.
$20 million. So hang on. Yeah. So hang on. This is what the viewer and the listener wants to know. So I just spent about half of my payroll on 7 players.
Mm-hmm.
8, I think.
I can think of another league where you do that.
Okay. I'm not questioning.
I think that's probably accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So half the payroll are 8 players. Then.
We haven't even mentioned Malachi Toney. Like, what did you spend to keep Malachi Toney?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm trying to establish this Miami methodology that everybody keeps talking about. So there's another bucket, and that's retention.
Yeah.
There would have to be, the retention bucket would have to be another $10 million.
At least.
Hang on. $10 million retention.
Is probably retention.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I feel like, Ross, there would be a graduated. So you have retention at kind of a significant Malachi Toney level, and then you would have retention at a more base level. Is that fair to bucket? Mm-hmm. So
also think that there's been some, they've hit on some people where they haven't spent a fortune. Like Keontae Scott, I don't imagine was a fortune last year to get. and he created incredible value for them.
All right. I still feel
we
like
should have said Dennis Smith on the show from Miami. He could give us all the real numbers.
I'm sure he just come out with all the numbers.
All right. That's right. By the way, there's an NFL GM that listens to the show, and I know I'm going to get a text after this because he's going to
Mark Fletcher Jr. By the way, another massive retention.
Oh yeah, he's going to spend there. He's going to call me and laugh about this. Okay, so hang on. All right, idiot proxy.
Ahmad Moten, the D tackle.
Hang on. Mm-hmm. Audience proxy here. Ready? Mm-hmm. I have four buckets that are roughly valued at anywhere from $8 to $10 million each.
Okay. Well, I will say you're using the 27 recruiting class.
Yeah.
That's not for this year.
So is the overall sum higher?
No. The 26 recruiting class was cheaper.
Right. But what I'm trying to do is project for the audience what it's going to be like as we go into February and in the future.
Projecting the
in rough Vince terms.
Mince is gone, so hopefully clear you spend out on some the quarterback money. Worked out.
Right.
So
right.
really,
and you're
okay.
clearing out
All
right. some.
So,
right.
so this is
you're not spending 6-7 probably on another. Well, you could be. I guess you could spend
yeah,
6-7
I mean,
on another transfer.
But hang on, is that quarterback going to be ready? The kid that they're spending the money on now, the freshman quarterback?
He better be, or they will probably find a way for him to transfer somewhere
else.
Hang
on, then.
And somebody else
But the next logical question is, then, are you investing in another national championship? Not playoff, national championship run now, because you have Mensa eating a chunk of this 1 year. This 1 year rental is about $6 million. And then are you expected to then create narrative next offseason and say, we paid for this long-term investment at quarterback. He needs his first year to start. By the way, this didn't go so well in Austin, Texas last year in terms of expectations. How do you get a five-star Jesus quarterback to play to that level of expectation if you're chasing a national title with a $6 million one-year rental? I still don't understand why this Miami methodology might be the way forward. This feels like it's riddled with potential problems.
See, that's the spending on the freshman quarterback is the anomaly here. That's not what they've been doing.
No, but
this is their third consecutive year with a one-year rental quarterback. The formula that Mario laid out for us was target specific positions in the portal right now to help you.
Yes.
Get the guys out of high school that you cannot get out of the portal. You can't get Reuben Bain out of the portal. You can't get CeCe Malinoa out of the portal.
Okay.
You can't get Malachi Toney out of the portal. And then also target, this is I think where it gets interesting. The guys with a bunch of years of eligibility left in the transfer portal, who you can get, they're going to be higher priced right now, but they're not going to be super high priced, and you may be able to get them.
All right, that third thing.
Zachariah Poyser, the safety who they got from Jacksonville State before last season, is a great example of this.
There's your money ball. Hang on, Andy. That third thing that you said, finding the value add in eligibility at a market rate. That is the actual sort of Billy Beane money.
Akeem Mesidor is the ultimate example of this.
Go on.
People look at Akeem Mesidor and are like, he was at Miami 4 years. Yes, he was.
Okay.
He was at West Virginia his first year, and people forget that.
Okay, so we're still strip mining other schools and catching guys for marginally better than they're making. So in other words, we still have a department somewhere in Coral Gables that's crunching film on Jacksonville State
100%.
And San Jose and all those schools, right?
Yes.
Okay. Of all the things that you've laid out here for me, and this is not I'm not trying to criticize Miami. We're just using them as an example. It seems like they're in the middle of an experimental change on how they're spending at the quarterback position. The problem, and I don't want to bog down the segment, is eventually you got to pay the piper on QBs. You either rotate a hot hand consistently trying to chase a title every year with no consistency like in Oregon, or you invest in a guy long term and then you expect a level of developmental time to be accounted for, right? Like a guy is not as good as his sophomore year as a starter as theoretically he is a senior.
But here's the other thing. This is where there's no CBA and the long-term deals maybe aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
Yeah.
If he sucks, just punt him.
The four buckets I made, Andy, the low return retention. So there's four buckets I made, which was the rentals that you talked about, the high-level high school investment, the high-level retention, Malachi Toney, the low-level retention. I think, as the layman, as the audience proxy here, I'm going to circle low-level retention is actually how you are building championship rosters, because other schools can do those other three things. If you can evaluate, if you can be a shark, a hell of a GM like in other pro sports, and find value at a lower rate, especially if you're talking about getting somebody on a 2-year deal from Conference USA, that's your championship. I think that's the difference.
Well, and well, there's one other place in the that you need to work in the margins.
Okay.
So you need to find the 4-star who's worth what a 5-star is worth. And then you need to find the 5 3-stars at the bottom of your class who are worth what 5 low 4-stars are worth.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Where are we putting the 3-stars? Like the there's like 30, 40 extra players, right?
Correct.
That we have. How are we paying them?
Have you guys voted in the AP poll or one of those polls before?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Godfrey, you've never done this, but I bet you will understand this immediately.
Yes.
When you get down to number 20 and you try to distinguish between teams 20 and 35, there's really no difference.
Right. Shit. Me, it started at like number 13 or 14.
You hear that, right. Ralph Russo? You never invited me, Ralph Russo. Did you hear that? They were just making it up halfway. And I did that.
The issue with the CFP of expands to 24. I mean, there are people right on the committee that are like, what the hell are we going to do at like 18, 17? They're all the same.
Way to go, Ralph.
Exactly. So I'm not saying they're all the same in recruiting because they're not.
No.
But the chances of the person ranked 500 being as good or better than the person ranked 350
pretty decent,
still fairly
chance.
High.
Oh God, yeah, then to wrap this up, I hate what I'm about to say so much. This reminds me then of the glorification of late round draft evaluation by like the early Belichick years in New England.
And they were really good at it.
But it's less draft. To be honest, Andy.
The short white receiver?
Oh, God. Just what the world needs.
The thing that makes it...
Edelman's everywhere.
Yeah, you want to know what makes this
all with
much
a podcast.
More difficult?
What?
And adds a lot of luck into it?
Yes.
Puberty.
Yeah. Okay, so this is where I was headed. This is not... You know, the funny thing is at the end of the day, NFL people I talk to are still like, hey, it is the draft. We might add a piece in free agency, but we're going to win a championship. We're going to win our division consistently because we draft well. This is not telling me this. What this is telling me is I need to pick the bones of other schools in an incredibly thoughtful way.
That is the more safe way to do it. It is much more safe to find the person. Akeem Mesidor played well as a freshman at West Virginia.
You know what?
That's easy.
I don't mean to put you...
That's an easy eval.
I don't mean to put you on the spot or your employer. This is going to change the paradigm of the on-threes and the scouts of the world because signing day is de-incentivized if this is true. Let me finish. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
However, if I'm the audience proxy, you're sort of in perpetuity with that evaluation process. If anything, and I'm sure you guys are cooking in the kitchen, it's... All right, who are the best 1-year starters at non-money schools, right? It's almost like it never ends. You guys could pivot into something here.
Yeah.
It does.
Well, it's like this is going to throw a curveball here and we don't have time to probably talk about it all, but like what's going to happen when the one-time transfer returns? And how that's going to impact contracts. like if the bill passes, it's got a one-time transfer.
Wouldn't they just immediately go to court?
I mean, it's a federal law. I mean, yeah, you can go to court.
Well,
I mean,
the bill's not going to pass, two, the schools will always create, this is the other part, schools will always create an escape hatch for themselves.
Yeah.
Well, the thought is if you sign out of high school, you're going to sign a 1-year deal. Because you only get one time to transfer, and on your second transfer, you're going
to
sign a 2 or 3-year deal.
Players, so that they'll create
the
a way
player
to cut
too,
players.
Right, the player's going to want free agency after his first year. Yeah. So, but his only transfer, allegedly, right? He's going to want to sign a long term deal.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's been a lot of
years.
Ross, I'd say there's a lot of hit dog hollers with coaches complaining about the fluidity of roster changes. But I would I would bolster what Andy's
most
saying.
Most of the time, it's their fault.
Yes, I would exactly hit dog hollers. I would bolster what Andy's saying is that if this bill were to pass, which we don't think it will, and we move aggressively in the other direction, the first thing coaches are going to try and do is build in, would you call it an escape hatch or a safeguard?
Yeah,
where you can
call it the runoff rule back in the day.
Yeah,
because coaches wanted to be able to run off players.
Correct.
They want to be able to fix their recruiting mistakes.
And remember, the only time that like you're raising hell about it when the kid leaves your program. You're also turning around and getting on the phone to raid someone else's program. Right. So I don't think that I don't see a one-time transfer rule ever surviving in any incarnation, federal law or not.
So America, we break the law. System. Yeah. I see a more orderly system where players who are unwanted get cut and get their free agency. So
yeah,
that would be, and look, I don't think that's a bad thing. That's like when we talked about this before in the years before all this, people are like, well, what are you going to say when coaches cut players? Nothing. They're getting paid. Like, you're paid to do a job. If you didn't do it to their satisfaction, that's on you. So that's, I mean, I think that's probably how you fix it. Fix it. Like
that. I'm still really worried that the center of economic innovation in a major American sport is South Florida. That feels like folks, that's terrifying.
I mean, it's not the first time, and it's been different industries. I mean, imagine what they've done for distribution and logistics. Like, what have distribution and logistics companies learned from South Florida?
This is the moment we wake up and we're like, oh, life is a Carl Hiaasen novel.
Former independent Florida Alligator reporter Carl Hiaasen.
Go Gator!
That's right. All right. When we return, Ross has an update for us. A little more about what's going on in Congress with the bill and also the lawsuits that we assumed were inevitable. Yeah, they were. We'll see how they're going. We'll be right back. We are back to College Football Inquirer, and our man Ross Dellinger has been hard at work on a story about what the Big Ten and the SEC want to see out of the Protect College Sports Act. And I think we've all talked about this. My skepticism on whether this bill will pass is well noted, but it would be a lot different, I think, in terms of skepticism, if the Big Ten and the SEC were on board. So what would they like to see?
Well, a lot of things, right? 10 things specifically is the latest sort of final recommendations that are being sent to lawmakers from the SEC and Big Ten. So I'll go through them really quickly. Number one is just stronger liability protection, right? I mean, the bill grants antitrust protection on the one-time transfer, like we mentioned earlier, the eligibility standard of 5 years, the cap. They don't think it's a strong enough protection. There's an avenue for players to still sue. And so they want that strengthened, of course. We talked about the NIL transparency, like sort of the database, right? That's one of them. There's some loopholes, at least this recommendation calls it loopholes, of NIL around NIL, which we talked about a couple weeks ago about associated entities and NIL and all that fun stuff. One of the more noteworthy recommendations is they'd like the mandate for schools to maintain their Olympic and non-revenue sports scholarship and roster funding. They don't like that. They want that.
But I thought they wanted to protect women's sports. Yeah, I thought that was the whole point of getting a law passed.
Surely that wasn't disingenuous.
They weren't lying to me in those TV commercials all season, were they?
Cody.
They would rather. The bill say that schools have to maintain the number of sports, not spending the same amount on scholarship and rosters.
I actually agree with them on this, by the way. Yeah. I'm making fun, but that you don't have to spend $1 million on a softball coach. Unless it's Patty Gasso, then you probably should.
Then you should.
And it wouldn't be coaches, right? Like underneath the current one, it's roster and it's roster spots and scholarship amounts is what they're talking about. Right. So it's not resources like a coaching staff, but you are right. Yeah, there's no reason for that spending. But anyway, one of the other thing is the applicability section that we've discussed before. They want this bill to apply to existing and pending lawsuits, including lawsuits over eligibility, which would include, say, a very famous Ole Miss quarterback who got an extra year of eligibility. So if the law would apply to that, he would not be eligible.
And Jeremiah Masoli. So a lot of
other people. So
Tom Mars that. Is just cracking his knuckles listening yeah. to this one.
And then I'd say lastly, some of the other recommendations are about Title II, quote, of the bill, right, which is the pooling of rights. They want in there mm-hmm. that pooling is definitely voluntary and they would not be forced into it, and they would not be forced into it through a court or through any kind of lawsuit.
Definitely voluntary.
They want more language in there that specifies that it's voluntary. And then they want stripped from the bill the scheduling requirement that would bring back and restore traditional rivalries. They want the schools to decide scheduling, not the
Can't
bill.
Make so us play Bedlam.
That is such ass. That is so, that is like God.
So Tin asks, I'm going to guess that actually they're probably going to get like five of them, right? Is that going to be enough?
No,
I would definitely put in the it's definitely voluntary language because
yeah.
It is definitely yeah. voluntary. Like, there's nothing in yeah, the language that makes it not voluntary.
I think there's a few things that are probably like more likely to be changed. Maybe that's one, Andy. Yeah.
Well, another that, one doesn't is. Doesn't cost you anything if you change it.
Yeah. Then another one is the anti-expansion provision. We talked about that, right? I had a story last week on that and how that's kind of caused a lot of consternation because it locks in everybody, including the G6. They can't move up. So that's going to probably change as well. I don't expect big things to change, though, like the applicability. Like, I don't think they're going to apply to pending lawsuits. Trinidad, will be okay.
I think the locking in the membership is a very big deal. If that changed.
Yeah, and that's going to change. I think that's going to change. But my sense is that would change. The ability for athletes to sue over certain things, I don't think that's going to change either.
You're already managing a pretty thin margin of Democrats who will, and you have to get 60 right. votes, right, to break the filibuster.
There's like a room of yep. smoke in it. They're like, yep. can we yep. take yep. away their ability to ever use yep. the legal system?
just, I mean, hey, man, we're just floating ideas. You're saying that like it's some yeah. smoky backroom deal. The one that was presented in the House of Representatives just came just right out and said
that. Absolutely.
The Olympic sport thing, that's not thuggery. That's not changing. I'd be shocked if that were to yeah. change, you know. Maybe half. They get maybe half of these. Maybe even they get like six or so. But the big ones, you know, maybe they don't get. But here's the question. If they get enough changes in the Title II, which the expansion stuff, the requirement, the pooling of rights stuff, will they come around? I think there's a lot of schools in their leagues that if you change a couple things entitled to, I think they would want to support the bill. And I'm just telling you guys, like, if the Big Ten and SEC come around to supporting this bill, the chances of this thing of like 30-40%, like I've said now for weeks, goes way up. And now we seriously talk about this passing Congress and being signed into law. But they got to come around in right now. They're not.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting part is how willing are Cruz and Cantwell to budge on
not
the
a lot.
Pooling of rights. Because I do think the pooling of rights, which doesn't really need to change because it is voluntary, like we said, but the freezing the conference membership in amber,
it's not going to happen,
is a huge problem. Yeah. But it's not yeah. just a problem for the SEC and the Big Ten. That's a problem for the ACC and the Big 12.
Very much. Yeah, that's the thing. They won't get the
every
votes
conference.
They need.
It's a problem.
They won't even get 30 votes if they don't change because it freezes all the G6. So I think that will change.
Why
maybe
would Campbell
they'll put
want
some,
that?
You know, language around pooling rights. And well, I mean, I know a lot of people think that he actually wrote the bill and everybody, there are
no,
other
just
people
paid
involved.
For
so somebody else
difference.
Probably wrote yeah,
the bill was written, but
look,
the bill was written.
ChatGPT wrote the bill. Cody paid for it. Okay.
the bill was written to acquiesce to his wishes, which is to keep Texas Tech in the club. Like, that's really all it comes
down to. But
that
conference stipulation is the opposite. Because guess, Cody
but he
Campbell
didn't
does.
Do that.
I know, that's what
that
yeah,
wasn't
he didn't
his
do everything. Right, that's the point I was making. Yeah. He did write everything here. I mean,
I think it turned in a way in which the initial real sponsors of this bill, the real ones, the ones who pay for Ted Cruz, didn't anticipate. And I think there has to be a pivot for this thing to survive to get back to the original intent. Because what they want is this a tale as old as time in America is to restrict all the things that they don't like or those beneath them and then still allow for their own upward mobility.
My guess is they make a change.
If the SEC and Big Ten can take other schools, if you get rid of that provision, if they're allowed to take other schools,
yes.
Like, if I'm them, I wouldn't care about the non-revenue sports clause because I have the money to deal with that. I can starve everybody else out until we move on to something different.
Still trying to figure out what first player-led lawsuit if this thing passes on, like which area,
probably either the transfer movement or the cap on compensation.
Yeah, I'm going to go again. Compensation first, probably. Last one. Yeah,
yeah. The compensation was a big one, but if they raise the cap, right, then that might prevent some legal issues. But
to raise it pretty high. But yeah,
who would be in charge of raising it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's within the settlement, so the conference commissioners have been meeting right about raising the cap.
Okay, so we're going to pass a bill that allows the conference commissioners solely to determine.
No. The cap is in the House settlement, right? So already the control over that the control over raising the cap is with the six defendants, the NCAA and the five conferences. Theoretically, they have to all agree on any changes to the settlement, including the cap. And so if they agree, they bring that change to the Jeffrey Kessler and Steve Berman, the plaintiff attorneys. They'd have to approve it. Then they have to bring it to the judge that's overseeing the House settlement. Then he or she, it's a he right now, Nathaniel Cousins, has to approve it. So that's kind of like the steps of how that goes. And they're in the middle of, you know, as we've talked about and as I've written about, they're in the middle of talking about changing the cap. But here's something new that's come up.
What's that?
Do you actually write language in the bill that raises the cap? Is there language in the bill?
But this can't be in stone. No,
then you have to go back to Congress every time you want to raise the cap,
this can't be in stone.
And that's another issue the SEC and Big Ten have noted is that because this bill is so prescriptive, you might have to go back to Congress to change all of this stuff when you need it changed.
It's almost as if you should not have Congress do this for you and you should do it yourself.
Drop the pretense, you greedy, myopic bastards, and just go and conduct your business.
People are starting to realize this was a bad idea 7 years ago coming here.
The best thing that can happen from this bill is that the people in charge finally realize that if they get what they ask for, they are going to be doomed. Keep Congress out of your business.
Before we finish, one more set of lawsuits because
it's football.
That's how these things go. But we knew this was coming. When they passed the 5-to-play-5 rule, we knew there was going to be a group of aggrieved people who were going to sue. In this case, the group of aggrieved people is the people who just finished playing, who played four seasons in 4 years, who are like, hey, wait a second. What about me?
Yep.
Ross, what's going on with those people?
Yeah, and the NCAA was, you know, I think back in March and April, I think a lot of people thought that the NCAA would grandfather in those players to receive a fifth year, and they ended up not doing it, partly because the board of directors didn't want them to do it. The schools didn't want that because they'd already set their rosters, and they didn't want to have to hold all these spots for all these players. So you've got – well, you're going to end up having dozens, right, of these players that file lawsuits for this fifth year. And the first hearing of those cases, which is 15 players, is in this single case that was filed in Ohio. The hearing was Wednesday. No ruling, probably no ruling until like next week, I'm going to guess. It's an injunction hearing for those 15 players to get their fifth year. And during the hearing, something interesting that ties back into to A Block, our first conversation, which was the Richard Pitino, the Xavier coach, saying that on cross-examination by the NCAA attorney, he revealed under oath that Xavier's men's basketball will be spending $14 million this coming season after it was reported that they spent around $5 million last year. So their amount tripled. And again, Xavier doesn't have a football team, right?
Yeah. The Jesuits can afford that. It's fine.
There's their rev share, which is probably in the neighborhood of what most SEC programs are spending on their rev share. on average. So it that was an interesting nugget that came from the hearing. We won't have a ruling, like I said, until probably next week. But yeah, the ruling is important because it could open the door for dozens more players to get their fifth year if they have a spot on their
school's roster. I feel for the schools on this one and the NCAA on this one a little bit.
Why?
Because they had to do something that, like, they've created it. They actually created a better system, a more efficient system, a less unfair system than the one they had before. And they had to do it. And there was a rip the Band-Aid off piece of it where they were going to get sued by some people. And they're just going to have to deal with
it. If you don't know how to patch drywall, don't throw a house party.
Well, listen, knowing how to patch drywall might be the most useful skill.
Absolutely.
In the history.
If you are a renter and you have a deposit.
Duct tape on it.
No. It's not that hard. I can show you.
Joint compound.
Yeah, a little joint compound, a little bit. The putty, you got to have good sanding.
We didn't get into that, no.
Yeah.
Too much work.
That's been Home Improvement with Ross, Godfrey, and Andy. They were going to have to deal with this all along. It is the toll you pay on the road to a more efficient system, but it's okay. It's not like they haven't paid lawyers before, so they'll figure
it out. Go to law school, kids. As always, the theme and the moral and the entire point of today's episode is go to law school.
Well, unless VAR says I can't do next episode, I think we're all back.
Keep your cleats down
on Tuesday.
Keep the spikes down, Andy.
We'll talk to you then.